Good afternoon, brethren. Our topic for this afternoon, as Brother Darwin stated, is God manifestation in the rainbowed angel. And I want you to, when we get started here, I want to try to create in your mind a mental image, and I want you to imagine yourself. You're laying in bed, and you know this happens sometime this year, this time of the year when the winter overtakes the summer, but you know, you hear the rumblings, you hear something in the distance, and you go, what was that? And then you realize it's thunder. You know, and gradually the thunder starts, you can hear it more and more distinctly. And the storm comes closer and closer. The thunder maybe starts to get kind of loud, and you'll see a lot of lightnings in the sky. Maybe you're in bed, and then all of a sudden, and this happened not too long ago down at the house, and have you ever been in bed in a thunderstorm? Hey, you have a thunderbolt or so loud that it just sits you straight up in bed. I mean, we had one not long ago, and it was real close, and it blew out all the power. But I mean, it just commands your attention. You're not going to lay there and through a thunderstorm that's right on you like that. You know, the power. You know, we think about the power. You know, we had an electrical storm recently, and it was just continually light outside. It was pretty. It's pretty amazing. I think, you know, we think about the, you know, many times it's accompanied by the rain, maybe hail, and so forth. And what I want you to do is, I think that has a little relation. It has a lot of relation to our subject. So I want you to keep this figure in your mind, even today in man with all his modern, sophisticated inventions. You know, in the face of a storm like that, a man is powerless. And I think, you know, what we're going to talk about, our subject this afternoon, is a storm that's coming. And this figure of the thunder and the storm and the hail and so forth, the lightnings, are all what the Scripture uses to describe this period that's coming on the earth. Now, next time we have a thunderstorm, you know, let it be a spiritual exercise in your mind. You know, use this, the power that we see in the elements, the natural elements. And we know this, it's the finger of Yahweh that controls all these things. You know, have your mind exercised about the storm that will be manifest in the rainbowed angel. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we move into our class here. Throw a picture up here that kind of, that doesn't all quite fit on there, but it's a quote from the 10th chapter of the Apocalypse, which has to do with our subject. This is where this term comes from, the rainbowed angel. I'll just read these first four verses off this slide. And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head. And his face was as it were the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. And cried with a loud voice, as when a lion roareth, and when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. And when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, I was about to write, and I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered, and write them not. Now, a point I wanted to make as we began this class is, I think it's important to set out some basic first principles that are set forth in this vision of the rainbowed angel that John saw. That's not very big, but it's interesting to, when I like this little graphic. I think it's really good and shows this in showing the structure of the apocalypse. I've got this in my Bible, and I got a little insert some time back. But you can see you have the eye of faith, as it were, looking through a telescope, and this telescope contains this structure of the apocalypse. Well, notice that in the apocalypse, it's a record of history, we know, from AD 96, Yahweh's plan unfolding. And it's interspersed with these visions of glory. And what are they for? But they're to encourage believers. Okay, so one of these visions of glory to encourage the believer is the vision of the rainbowed angel, which is our subject this afternoon. We can see there in the 10th, 11th, and the 19th chapters, we have the rainbowed angel in chapter 10, and then the temple in heaven in 11 and 19. So as we go down through the unveiling of Yahweh's plan in the earth, The rainbowed angel is a vision that's given to encourage believers and to strengthen them. So let's keep that in mind when we look through here. This subject that we're covering is based upon, it's I know that when I was a young brother, there a brother who will remain nameless, but he sits in the room with us today, had a talk on the 10th chapter of Revelation. His brother Darrell, as a matter of fact. And I said I was a young brother. I'm sorry, I was not baptized. I heard this talk. I left the room that day determined to be baptized. You know, so vivid was the picture painted in my mind of what was coming on the earth, I knew that I must be part of it. So it's very, very encouraging. Okay? And it's first principle. We're not talking about, you know, when you hear these terms, the rainbowed angel, we think about, well, these are these apocalyptic symbols that are just for our learned brethren to understand. Not at all. This is just talking about Christ and His reign on the earth. This is in our statement of faith. You know, the Yahweh will set up a kingdom on earth which will overthrow all others and change them into the kingdom of our Lord and His anointed one. So we're talking about a very first principle thing. What we teach our children, Christ is coming to set up a kingdom. So that's our subject this morning. The mission of the kingdom will be to subdue all its enemies and finally death itself. Now, if that's not encouraging to us, I mean, what is? I mean, that's what we look forward to. You know, it's very dear to us. Yahweh has condescended to inform us of what He intends to do before He does it. You know, just think about that. I mean, it's incredible. And Amos 3:7, I have for a reference. I'm not going to go there. Y'all all know the verse. Yahweh has condescended to reveal these things to us. So what is it? It's incumbent upon us to the very best of our ability to try to understand it. He's really revealed in great detail in how He intends to do this, set His kingdom up on the earth. So as faithful servants and good stewards of what He has given us, it's we need to read and understand it to the best of our ability. The last point I would make, just in introductory, is life is the time to serve Yahweh. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. And that's so true. You know, we talked about, you know, the great enemy in the last class. We talked a little bit about this great enemy we have. Brother Mack mentioned it. The body of this death. Okay, that's our enemy. And he's, you know, our natural flesh is going to succumb to this body we have. This frame we have is not going to last too long. Okay, so life is the time to serve Yahweh. And He's revealed to us what He will do if we will serve Him and be obedient to His precepts. Let us consider this testimony and examine ourselves. Let this be a, you know, this is a wonderful subject. There's no way that I can cover it in any kind of detail in the period we have here today. You know, let this be an exhortation to us to encourage us all to study these things on our own, because I can sit up here and, you know, Brother Scott said this and he went in through these verses. But you know, unless you sit down yourself and study these things for yourself and become excited in your mind. I mean, how many of you have you sat down and studied and had a chill run up the back of your neck when you're looking at a verse and you've looked up a word and you go, you know, it's amazing. Yahweh used this word here to teach us. And you see that and it just excites you so much. Well, I can't do that for you. So hopefully just our little time we spend this morning will encourage you to really look into this. It's a most exciting subject because of what it does. It's a change in the earth. The earth is going to change, and this is the phase when the earth changes and the kingdom becomes a reality. What is meant by this term, the rainbowed angel? We looked and we saw in the verses in the Apocalypse where the term comes from. We noticed that, you know, there were several symbols used. The angel had a rainbow around his head. He was clothed with a cloud. Face was as the sun, feet pillars of fire, a voice with a lion, like a lion roaring, and when you heard the voice, it was like thunders. You know, we talked about the thunder cloud and the thunderstorm. Well, if you conjure up a mental image of something that looks like that and makes those kind of noises, that can be kind of fearsome, can't it? It's a really kind of a vivid mental picture and some powerful symbols. So, but really what it is, and what Yahweh is showing us, that there will be, as we've talked about all morning, it's a glorious multitude that has had immortality bestowed upon them. You know, the scriptures say a number so great that no man can number them. They're bearing Yahweh's name. They're going forth in judgment. They're going forth as a military formation to establish the kingdom, like we have in our statement of faith, that like we have over here in the picture. You know, the Nebuchadnezzar's image, the stone will come, it will smite the image, which will be the beginning of this kingdom period. This manifestation of Yahweh as a great army, in an invincible army, with irresistible force, is known in the scriptures as, we see it a lot of times, this title in the scriptures, the Lord of Hosts, or Yahweh of Armies, or He who will be armies. Now, you thought we were finished with the Valley of Elah, but we're going to go back and look at David again just a minute, because I want you to look at 1 Samuel 17 again, and I want to bring to your attention something that we read over, but in verse 45, remember what David said when he came out to fight. He said, "I come to thee in the name of the Lord of Hosts, or Yahweh of Hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied," and so forth. So notice the name that David invokes when he comes out to fight. And we've already brought to your attention the pronoun change, where he comes out and he will, the giant will be delivered into his hand, and then it will be into their hands, or our hands. Now, this title is closely related to our subject, the Lord of Hosts. What it is, it's prophetic of a future deliverance of Israel, and it's connected with David's calling also. I think, you know, last night we were studying in Joseph, you know, at the Bible school. We were studying Elf Israel, and we were studying the parable of Joseph. And Brother Thomas makes a comment to the effect that, you know, when we read through Joseph's life, if we read about it like we're reading about Jesus, there's much light we can get on what Jesus was to do. Because it's, you know, there's even things that are revealed in the life of Joseph that may not be anywhere else, in the prophecies or in the Gospels and so forth. Well, I believe, in like manner, when we read about David's life, and this has been mentioned already this morning, that the period of David, you know, David was a mighty warrior. He was a warrior king, and he subdued Israel's enemies under them, and then which made for the reign of his son Solomon to be a peaceful one. They had rest from their enemies. This David period, this period of 40 years, is going to be a period of there's going to be much activity going on in the earth. I mean, if you look forward, the period when Christ is in the earth, and all the work of the saints in subduing the enemies of this kingdom and in setting up the kingdom being established in the land. Okay? Now, I believe that the 40 years of David's reign is I think we can carry that forward. I believe it's going to be a 40-year period in the establishment of the nations will be subdued in. Okay, the influence of the rainbow and angel will extend all the way through the thousand year reign of Christ. But a lot of times we think about the work of the rainbow and angel as, you know, the great belligerent work of Christ and the saints, or the military work will be done in these first 40 years. There's more we could say about that, but we'll just leave it right there for now. I think this period of David, though, foreshadowed the future work of a strong man. You know, David was this strong man, as this rainbowed angel will be. Let's look at Psalm 19:5. I think which can help us kind of set the time frame. I'm going to read verse 1, and then I'll skip down to 5. The heavens declare the glory of El, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. And then we read verse 5, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoiceth as a strong man to run a race. So I think this can kind of give us the time frame here. We have the judgment of the household is passed. It's already happened. The saints have been judged. The worthy have been given immortality. The great marriage has taken place. The great marriage. You know, David's victory was to win for him a bride. Well, Christ's victory will win for him a bride. The bride's prepared. She has made herself ready, as we read over in the 19th chapter of the book of Revelation. The marriage of the Lamb hath come. And so in this, this word chamber in verse 5 really is a, the Hebrew is, it means a marriage canopy. So it has to do with a marriage canopy. Of course, the bridegroom is departing from there. And then he's a strong man. He comes out as a strong man. David came out to battle the strong man in the name of the He who will be armies, as we've noted. So we have, in this contest, typically we have a strong man coming out of the bridegroom's chamber. And then we have the strong man of flesh over here in Nebuchadnezzar. And the battle's ready. Now Habakkuk describes this strong man in the second chapter in verse 5. Let's look at that reference. Habakkuk 2, 5. Yea, also because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as hell and as his death, and cannot be satisfied, but gathereth unto him all nations, and heapeth unto him all people. Shall not all these take up a parable against him, and a taunting proverb against him, and say, Woe to him that increaseth that which is not his? How long? And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay? So, you have the multitudinous Christ body and this multitudinous man of flesh that heaped unto him all nations. It's a multitude of peoples. And across to one end we have the field, we have David, the beloved. And he's a man that, now when we look back at the natural, I think we can get another lesson. Now when Goliath came onto the field of battle and David came out, you know, Goliath reviled him. Who is this? You know, this little stripling. David did not appear powerful, did he? Not at all. Goliath was, you know, who am I, a dog, that you send this, this little shepherd boy out against me? David did not appear, Goliath did not feel threatened by David. We know what happened. He lost his head, though. Well, so his power was hidden, so to speak. As a matter of fact, in verse 56, of 1 Samuel 17, you don't have to turn back there, but remember after the battle, and isn't it interesting? I find it fascinating that, you know, Saul had just offered David his armor and everything, and then the battle's over, and Saul goes, inquire thou whose son the stripling is. Who is this stripling? And if you, and I also found it very interesting, if you go look up this word stripling in your concordance, literally the Hebrew means something kept out of sight. Something kept out of sight, or something hidden. And we know that David's power and his strength was not through the flesh, but in the name of the Lord of hosts, the He who will be mighty ones, whose honor he sought to defend. The giant did not even consider David a worthy opponent. I think we see in David another man. We see, you know, the rainbowed angel, or the multitudinous Christ. I think, I've got an overhead here, it may not be very easy to see. We'll see how it comes out. It's kind of, some of the lettering is kind of small. But all this is, it's a table that compares some of these references that use, that speak of this symbolic man. We have, it's referred to, you know, this rainbowed angel, and in other places also, he's referred to in a singular sense. If we go to Ephesians 4:13, you know, the Apostle Paul has a verse where he refers, I think, to this completed man, this multitudinous man. He says, till we all come in the unity of the faith, or the, you know, and it's interesting, Brother Mack brought up that word Ikad, and in Daniel 1, he's called Ish Ikad, the man of the one. Well, this, and he noted how that word means unity. Well, note the apostle's language here, till we all come in the unity of the faith. Well, when is that? Is he just talking about in the ecclesia today? I think he's talking about it even in a more remoter sense than that even. And to the knowledge of the Son of God, unto a perfect man, or a man brought to his complete end, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. So this is kind of small to see, and but we have noted here the 10th chapter of the Apocalypse, the rainbowed angel. It's also the same figure we see in the first chapter, in Daniel 10, the man of the one, in Daniel 7, and then Ezekiel 1, in the vision of the cherubim. We see some of these symbols there too. I'll be glad to share this with you if you want to see it later. I'm not going to leave it up here because we haven't got time to go into all of it. But this is something, it's the first principle. You know, Abraham, when the promises were made to Abraham, he was told his seed, if a man could number the dust of the earth, so shall thy seed be numbered. And then we go all the way over to the Apocalypse from Genesis, and what's it say? It says in chapter 7 and verse 9, after this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude, which no man could number, of all nations, kindreds, and peoples, and tongues, stood before the throne, before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, and palms in their hands. We know this is the redeemed. So we have a link. This is the theme that runs all through the Scripture. Although these saints have been granted immortality, and we are told it will be a great number, they are singular in purpose. And that's why it's referred to as a single man, or the man of the one. They're unified in purpose and act in total concert. I think this is a pretty straightforward principle. We can all understand that. Now, I got a note here out of Eureka. This is in Volume 3, where Brother Thomas is writing about the rainbow symbol. He says this symbol occurs only twice in the book of Revelation, once in the 4th chapter and again in the 10th. When seen by the scribe instructed for the kingdom of the heavens, and that's us, it reminds him of the covenants of promise in which he has become interested in by adoption into the commonwealth of Israel when he put on Christ by immersion as the obedience of faith. The rainbow token in a scene reminds him that the symbol with which it is associated has to do with the Holy Land and the kingdom of which the land is the territory. This is a first principle. It suggests that the things signified by the symbol are connected with the avenging of the holy, when the covenant with Jacob and the covenant with Isaac and the covenant with Abraham has been remembered, and the land also. And I have a note here that we've already pretty much said it. This is the first principle, the setting up of the kingdom. And the bow associated with the angel is related to the covenant. I would encourage you to go to Volume 2 of Eureka and read pages 36 through 41 on the rainbow symbol. We've got some young science students in here, I'm sure, that could explain this better than I could, but everybody knows what it takes to get a rainbow. What's it take to get a rainbow? It takes sun, it takes rain. Sun is shining, rain is falling. And, you know, of course, the sun comes and the raindrop acts as a what? A prism, right. So the sun is refracted through the water, and it forms an arch on the clouds opposite the sun, doesn't it? If we think about these natural facts, what makes a rainbow, it'll help us understand it spiritually a lot better. The water acts like a prism. I hadn't got an overhead, but you know, if you've got a prism like this, and the sun is shining into the prism, we know the light is refracted. And I've got to draw 7 of these out here, don't I? And it's bent into 7 colors, isn't it? And the colors go from what to what? Well, this is white light. We have, isn't it interesting how you have the pure white light and it turns into 7? Okay, and they go across the spectrum, don't they? They go from red to purple to violet, right? The various shades between it. Now, isn't it interesting that, you know, the long wavelengths are bent the least? Consider the prism. Of course, we know the water acts as the prism. So consider the light as the light of the truth. You know, the light is the Word that's a lamp unto our feet. And then you have the water, which is also a symbol for the Word, the washing of the water of the Word. So the Word, the light through the Word, reflected through the Word. Well, the wavelengths that are bent the least are red. The wavelengths that are bent the most are the violet end of the spectrum. Well, I think we can even see a spiritual lesson in that, can't we? You know, we see sin's flesh is affected the least by the light through the Word. But anyway, we could, you know, there's a lot we could, you know, you could spend a lot of time on the symbol here. It's really beautiful. But this, the bow is a sevenfold manifestation of divine glory. We've got to go look at Genesis 9 just a little bit. Let me read verses. Well, I'm going to read 5 verses, 12 through 17. This is after the flood, so notice the time frame. And God said, "This is the token of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for," let me read this, "as generations of Olam." And we've had that word, the generations of the hidden period. Verse 13, "I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of the covenant between me and the earth. And it shall come to pass, when I bring a cloud over the earth, that the bow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you, and every living creature of all flesh, and the waters shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh. And the bow shall be seen in the cloud, and I will look upon it, that I may remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is upon the earth." And again, that verse 16, we could read the covenant of the Olam, or the kingdom age. Verse 17, "And God said unto Noah, this is the token of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is upon the earth." And before we leave here, just notice that the bow is associated with the cloud. The bow is related to the cloud here in these verses. In verse 13, we have kind of a, beginning at verse 13, we have kind of a progression. We have, it says in verse 13, "I will set my bow." In the Hebrew means I've appointed it. Verse 14, it says the bow shall be seen, which I think is a prophecy. And then in verse 16, the bow shall be in the cloud. So we have a reality, and which means it has come to exist, and it is a accomplished thing. So we have I think in these verses here, we have a progression. We have, you know, Yahweh's appointed the bow as a token of the covenant. He said that the bow shall be, and then the bow shall be seen, and then the bow shall be, or exist as a reality. These points are also out of Eureka on volume 2, page 37, under the heading of the development of the bow. First of all, we have the opening of the heaven in Revelation 4:1. Let's read that quickly. This is one of the interspersed visions of glory that we were referring to earlier. But chapter 4, verse 1 says of the apocalypse, "After this I looked, and behold, a door was opened in heaven, and the first voice which I heard was as it were of a trumpet talking with me, which said, Come up hither, and I will show thee things which must be hereafter." This happens as a result of the stone power smiting Nebuchadnezzar's image on the feet. And think about David. You know, David used a stone to conquer his enemy also. Let's just look over at Genesis 49, verse 24. I think this is a good reference because it was a prophecy of Joseph. We can see a tie into David and to Christ also. "But his bow abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel." Next, we have the establishment of the throne in heaven by the mowing the earth at harvest time. "In the storm period of the lightnings, thunders, and voices proceeding from the throne, by which the kingdoms of the world are taken possession of by the saints." Next, "the grass of the earth, thus being mown, its harvest reaped, and in the vintage trodden out, the rain of heaven descends in the blessing of Abraham upon the nations, which being subdued, are blessed in Abraham and his seed, or in Jesus and the saints." You know, and that's the great promise of the gospel. You know, that was the gospel preached to Abraham, that all the nations should be blessed in his seed. So this becomes a reality in the earth. "As the brightness of the morning, the ruler rises the sun of an unclouded dawn, shining forth after rain upon the tender grass of the earth, The effect of the shining is that the rainbow throne covenanted to David is beheld through the descending rain, which diffuses the knowledge of its glory to the utmost bounds of the habitable world. So this is the influence of this rainbow throne will last for 1,000 years. 1,000-year reign of Christ. Now, initially, as we've said, that when this rainbowed angel manifests itself, it's going to be a period of great turmoil and chaos in the earth. And it will be like the thunderstorm that approaches your house in the middle of the night when you're laying on your bed. And when it finally gets to your yard and sets you up in bed, well, that's what's going to happen to the nations of the earth. This will be a period which no corner of the earth will be unturned from this event. Okay? It's a transitional period when the earth comes under the rule of David's throne. Now, we know that Yahweh, if He desired, could bring about the subjugation of the nations just like that. He is not required to militarily overtake the armies of flesh, is He? I mean, he could do like that, and everything would be established. But why does He not do that? I think, I'm going to read Isaiah 26:9 for you. You don't have to turn there, but you can write it down if you want to. But it's know the verse. For when thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the earth or the world will learn righteousness. I think the point I would like to make is that this, in effect, is an act of mercy. It's a characteristic of the name. When Yahweh comes into the earth to destroy the kingdom of men, set up the reign of His Son, this subjugation, this period of turmoil, is an act of mercy because some will survive out of it. Look at Habakkuk 3, verse 2, please. O Yahweh, I have heard thy speech and was afraid. O Yahweh, revive thy work in the midst of the years, and in the midst of the years make known. And look at this phrase here, in wrath remember mercy. That sounds kind of a little bit strange, doesn't it? But I think that in wrath, in His putting down of all the wickedness, He's remembering mercy. He's reviving. What is the work to be revived in the midst of the years? It's the revival of His work, of the manifestation of His name. He began it in His Son. He's glorified His Son physically. He's going to do it in a multitude of men. He's going to finish His family, or begin the completion of His family. It's the prophecy of the memorial name that we heard about this morning, given it at the burning bush, in wrath against all unrighteousness, to remember mercy, to remember His redeemed. Let's look at Isaiah 63, verse 4. For the day of vengeance is in mine heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. And I looked, and there was none to help, and I wondered that there was none to uphold. Therefore mine own arm brought salvation unto me, and my fury it upheld me. And I will tread down the people in mine anger, and make them drunk in my fury, and I will bring down their strength to the earth. Now note this, that language of vengeance and destruction. Then He says, I will mention the loving kindnesses of Yahweh, and the praises of Yahweh, according to all that Yahweh hath bestowed on us, and the great goodness toward the house of Israel, which He hath bestowed on them according to His mercies, according to the multitude of His loving kindnesses. So there again we have all this wrath and turmoil coupled with love and mercy and attributes of the name. Let's look at Isaiah 66, verse 16. This is another reference that shows us it's going to be a period of turmoil. For by fire and by His sword shall Yahweh plead with all flesh, and the slain of Yahweh shall be many. I think we read that verse already once this morning. And then in Jeremiah 25, verse 30. And I think when we read verses 30 through 33, we can see the clear connection to the rainbowed angel, the language used for the rainbowed angel. Therefore prophesy thou against all these words, and say unto them, but Yahweh shall roar. That's what the angel did also. It roared. Yahweh shall roar from on high and utter His voice from His holy habitation. He shall mightily roar upon His habitation. He shall give a shout as they tread the grapes against all the inhabitants of the earth. A noise shall come even to the ends of the earth, for Yahweh hath a controversy with the nations. He will plead with all flesh. He will give them that are wicked to the sword, saith Yahweh. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, Behold, evil shall go forth from nation to nation, and a great whirlwind shall be raised up from the coast of the earth. And the slain of Yahweh shall be at that day from one end of the earth even to the other end of the earth. They shall not be lamented, neither gathered nor buried. They shall be as dung upon the ground. It's important for us to remember, so when we're considering this subject, is that Yahweh's name, wherever it's manifest or whenever it's manifest, in whatever mode or method He may choose to do it in, the principles characterized by the name are present. And let's look at Exodus 34, verses 5 through 7. And Yahweh descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of Yahweh. And Yahweh passed by before him and proclaimed, Yahweh, Yahweh, Elohim, merciful and gracious, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and that will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children unto the third and fourth generation. So these principles here, this sevenfold manifestation of the characteristics of Yahweh's name, are always present wherever He has manifested His name. And one of those principles we can see is that He will not clear the guilty. Also, notice that this is connected with the cloud again. This is when Moses requested to see the glory of Yahweh. So it is an act of mercy, the day of vengeance. He is not willing that all should perish. Let's just talk, I guess, a little brief outline of the period. We know, I believe, that the saints, when the Lord returns and raises the dead first, that He's going to gather us to Sinai. And that will be the locality of the judgment seat. This is our ordeal that we will have to go through before we become a part of this body, if indeed we become a part of it. That should be quite an exhortation, I guess, just to sit and to think about, consider, what it'll be like wherever we may be when we're called off to that judgment seat to give account of what we've done, how have we spent our time, and so forth. It will be an ordeal for even the strongest of us. Some are going to be glorified and given immortality with joy unbelievable. Others will be consigned to shame. So it is from here, where this great marriage takes place, that the rainbowed angel will begin its movement, I believe. Let's look at Deuteronomy 33. There's three scriptures, and we're just going to look real briefly at them. First one, Deuteronomy 33:2. I believe the scriptures are pretty clear as to this right here, to the locale to where the saints move from. And he said, I'm going to begin in verse 2, and he said, Yahweh came from Sinai. Now, Brother Thomas translates this, Yahweh came in from Sinai. And he rose up from Seir unto them, he shined forth from Mount Paran, and he came with 10,000s of saints from his right hand went a fiery law for them. Now, at first, we may think that this sounds like this may be just historical, that this is made to deal with the children of Israel as they came out of Egypt. But if we look a little closer, we can see that, verses 26 through 29, if you look down at those and read through those are definitely future. They're prophetic. They have not happened yet. Some of this language that's used in these early verses here, rose up, literally means to shoot forth beams. To shoot forth beams. Think about the figure of the horn we looked at in our last period when we talked about David. Shined forth from Mount Paran. The illusion of the breaking forth of a day. We read a little further on in the chapter that there was a fiery law that went forth. We talked about fire this morning. Fire is a method of judgment. It's also connected with mercy, as we were shown. Consider who the them in this passage refers to. I think it's talking clearly of Israel. which is clear from the phrase that follows those early verses. It says, yea, he loved all the people. I mean, this doesn't make any sense if it's referring to strictly a past tense as Israel coming from Sinai. Let's look at another reference over in Psalm 68, verse 1. Let God arise, let his enemies be scattered. Let them also that hate him flee before him. Now, David is quoting Numbers 10, verse 35. Now, look at Numbers 10, 35. Hold your finger there in Psalm 68 and look back at Numbers 10, 35. I want you to see the difference. It says, and it came to pass when the ark set forward that Moses said, rise up, Yahweh, and let thine enemies be scattered, and let them that hate thee flee before thee. Each day in the wilderness, the ark, when it moved, was heralded by these words. And in verse 36 of Numbers 10, we read, and when it rested, he said, return, O Yahweh, unto the many thousands of Israel. Now, it's significant that the word quoted in the psalm, which deals with the bringing of the ark to Jerusalem, which is in Psalm 68, in the progress of the ark through Canaan and the bringing of the ark to Jerusalem, are highly typical events. Anytime we read about the ark moving, we need to pay close attention because I think it's related to our subject. Look at 1 Samuel 4:4. We talked this morning about the cherubim, and Brother Mac gave us a good lessons on the cherubim, and he set forth that Yahweh dwelled between the cherubim. Look at the language here. It says, so the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring from thence the ark of the covenant of Yahweh of hosts, which dwelleth between the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the ark of the covenant of God. Note here that the belligerent name of deity, or the military name, he who will be armies, is said to dwell between the cherubim. So we can see that the movement of this ark, you know, can be this manifestation of a belligerent character. There are seven psalms that are associated with this movement of the ark, David's movement of the ark to Zion. So it's very significant. But back in Psalm 68, David substitutes. He says in Psalm 68:1, we already read. He says, "Let God arise, or let Elohim arise." Or mighty ones. Now, there's a difference between Psalm 68 and Numbers 10. Moses said, let Yahweh arise. So, Moses was speaking prophetically, I believe, let the He who will be arise. And David said, let mighty ones arise. David was seeing the reality of the saints as a glorified host marching from the south, I believe, in Psalm 68. So, we have a difference. He quotes the Numbers passage, but with a difference. He uses a different name. Note verse 4 of Psalm 68. Sing unto God, sing praises to His name, extol Him that rideth upon the heavens by His name, Yah, and rejoice before Him. Rotherham has rideth up through the waste plains. The words heavens here is Araba, and should read literally, through the deserts, which is in agreement with this host coming up from the south, from this region of Sinai. And then in verse 7, it says, O mighty ones, or Elohim, when thou wentest forth before thy people, when thou didst march through the wilderness, Selah, the earth shook, the heavens also dropped at the faces of mighty ones. Even Sinai itself was moved at the faces of mighty ones, the mighty ones of Israel. And then look down at verse 17. The chariots of God are 20,000, even thousands of angels. The Lord is among them, as in Sinai, in the holy place. Thou hast ascended on high, thou hast led captivity captive, thou hast received gifts for the men. For men, yea, for the rebellious also, that the Lord God, or Yahweh God, might dwell among them. Now, this translation is a little confusing in the King James. If you just read this verse 17 and you leave the italics out, it's a little better if you just read it without the italics, like the chariots of God, 20,000, thousands of angels, Lord, the Lord among them, Sinai in the holy. Actually, Brother Thomas has a translation on page 98 of Phanerosis that makes it a little easier to understand. He says, the chariots of mighty ones are 2 10,000s, thousands of glorified ones. That word there, in our version, says angels, really is a poor translation. It can be changed ones or glorified ones is better. Thou hast ascended on high. Thou hast led captivity captive. Thou hast received gifts for the man, yea, even for Yah Elohim to inhabit rebellious ones. So it's pretty clear when we understand we're talking about the saints moving from Sinai that we've had brought to our attention that the saints are as a chariot. A chariot is strictly a war vehicle. It's not good for anything else. It's a war vehicle. Yahweh is riding the chariot from Sinai toward the sanctuary or into Jerusalem. Back over in Habakkuk 3, verse 1, a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet upon Shigionoth. Habakkuk 3 is a psalm also. Shigionoth signifies a cry of joy. It's a cry of joy by the exalted bride. It's only used here in chapter 7, Psalm 7, where it's in the plural, in the singular, in Psalm 7. And I think there's an interesting comparison. If you go to Psalm 7, we can see how it applies in the singular. It speaks of a suffering Savior. And then here we have the cry again, and it's in the feminine plural. Verse 3 says, God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran, Selah. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of His praise. This verse should be translated in the future tense. We should read it, and here the word God is the singular of Elohim. It's Eloah, and it means a strong one or a mighty one. So we should read this as Eloah. Eloah comes in from Teman. Eloah shall come in. I lost my place here. Pardon me. Eloah shall come in from the south, or Teman. Eloah shall come in from the south. Eloah is the same word that we read about. It's the same word used in Daniel 2:44 for the setter up of the kingdom. The God of heaven shall set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and so forth. It's the same word. Now, from our studies this morning, we can see we should have no problem with this word, this singular word being used for Christ and the saints coming up, because we've talked about how it's a multitude, but they're singular in purpose, and they're mentioned and they're called a man of the one, and so forth, a rainbowed angel. So Habakkuk refers to this host coming from the region of Paran, and that agrees with what we've read back in Deuteronomy 33 and also in the 68th Psalm. Look at verse 4. And his brightness was as the light. He had horns coming from out of his hand, and there was the hiding of his power. Before him went the pestilence, and burning coals went forth at his feet. So again, we have some significant language. Brightness as the light, face as the sun. We were talking earlier about the rainbowed angel. Again, I want to draw your attention to this word here, horn. We were looking at this slide earlier, and we talked about the horn of strength, and then we talked about the horn as a container for oil. The sun, the manifestation of the sun, he was filled with oil, as was David. Well, we also have here a horn as a musical instrument, a horn as in the horn-like projections of the altar, the rays of light. We read about the rays of light here in Habakkuk's prophecy, his psalm, and also a hill or a mountain. When David was anointed with the oil, it imparted him strength. We also see that the horns can signify strength, a flask-like container for oil, the horn-like projections of the altar, and so forth. I think it's interesting because all the lessons from this word are significant in what we're looking at here in this study. As the saints come from the south, sons of oil, as manifestations of these cherubim, they're going to project power, song is going to be associated with this march, as it was in the past. They manifest this four square, or the altar was four square. What did it have on the corner? It had horns on the corner, if you recall. I want to read to you a comment. This is out of Eureka, Volume 1. And Brother Thomas ties the horns on the altar. It's the same word used. As a matter of fact, if you go back into Exodus and you read about the construction of the altar, well, this word Kerin is used to describe the horns on the corner of actually the brazen altar and the altar of incense. But Brother Thomas says the brazen altar and its horns of brass then are symbolical of Ael, or just or power or might. The eternal power in Elohistic or sacrificial and judicial manifestation in flesh. Elohim will come in from Teman, saith the prophet, the Holy One from Mount Paran. Consider, His glory covers the heavens, and His praise fills the earth. And the splendor shall be as the light. He has horns out of His hand, and there is the covering of His strong ones. Before His faces shall go pestilence, and from His feet lightnings shall proceed. He stood and measured the earth. He beheld and caused the nations to tremble. And the mountains of antiquity were dispersed, and the hills of the Olam did bow. The goings of the Olam are His. The horns of the brazen and golden altars, so He uses both these altars in this figure, are the eternal spirit's strong ones, who disperse the empires of antiquity and subjugate the kingdoms of the latter days to Him and His anointed, so that the current of the world's affairs will be directed by His Elohim in the ensuing 1,000 years, or Daniel's season and a time. So that's going to be the influence of the bow will last for Daniel's season and a time. The whole 1,000 years will be under the influence of this bow. And he shows that in his 4 points on the development of the bow. Now David was David was known to be a skilled warrior. What else was David known for? He was a musician extraordinaire. He had 4,000 people in his temple orchestra. 4,000 people playing instruments and praising Yahweh. Can you imagine, brethren, what that would be like to hear 4,000 skilled musicians on instruments that David made? David had time to make instruments. He was a skilled musician and singer. The horn as a significant instrument of music is very, I think it's interesting in this context. It was used by the priest. Look at Joshua 6:6. I'm running just a little bit over, but I'm sorry. I just got a little bit more and I'll be done. And Joshua, the son of Nun, called the priest and said unto them, take up the Ark of the Covenant and let 7 priests bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of Yahweh. Here again, anytime brothers and sisters were reading and we read about the Ark moving, let's pay attention. Of course, we know Joshua was moving this Ark for the destruction of Jericho. And it's right along with our lesson we're studying right now. It's just in another, it's in a typical sense. Also, in Joshua 6, note verse 8. And it came to pass when Joshua had spoken unto the people that the 7 priests bearing the 7 trumpets of ram's horns passed on before Yahweh and blew with the trumpets. And the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh followed them. And then in verse, go ahead and read through 10. And the armed men went before the priest that blew with the trumpets, and the river ward came after the ark, the priest going on and blowing with the trumpets. And Joshua had commanded the people, saying, ye shall not shout, nor make any noise with your voice, neither shall any word proceed out of your mouth until the day I bid you shout. Then shall you shout. Now, I think it's interesting here. Again, we have a type foreshadow of the hiding of the power. We read about the hiding of the power in Habakkuk real clearly. The strong ones will be covered. And David was a stripling. He was hidden. Goliath feared not David. There, and he lost his head. His head was lost because he didn't fear him. David ran unto him, and Goliath didn't turn around and run. Here, he said, don't shout or make any noise with your voice. Don't make any commotion. I would imagine the people of Jericho kind of sneered when they saw this ark marching around, these people blowing these horns. They probably thought they were crazy. They didn't try to run and hide. But notice in verse 15 and 16 of the same chapter, at the dawning of the day, it came to pass on the seventh day that they rose early about the dawning of the day and compassed the city after the same manner seven times. And what did they do? They blew the horns and they shouted. Verse 16, shout, for Yahweh hath given you the city. And so forth. But song and music on the horn will be a part of this host as it comes from the south. It probably will not appear real threatening to these armies of the flesh. They'll probably think of some religious zealots from the wilderness. You know, or look at Exodus 15, verse 2. This is another typical incident on this day of vengeance. It says, Yahweh is my strength and song. Yahweh is my strength and song, and He's become my salvation. He is my mighty ones, and I will prepare Him an habitation, my Father's mighty ones, and I will exalt Him. Yahweh is a man of war. Yahweh is His name. Let's look at Psalm 15. And, you know, we talked, the horn also represents a hill or a mountain. Yahweh, who shall abide in thy tabernacle, or who shall dwell in thy holy hill? He that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh the truth in his heart. And Lord willing, we'll talk some more to the mountain and the hill and tomorrow morning. I got just a couple of slides and we'll be done. I want to read you some comments on what brother. This is something that, you know, we think about when we read the language of the Rabban angel. It's a glorious, mighty force. Very, very powerful. But I believe, as we see from the Scriptures, that this power will be hidden. Because let me just read what Brother Thomas says. He'll do a better job. The RSV renders... Okay, this first quote is from the Habakkuk Expositor. I'm sorry, this is not... I've got his Brother Thomas also. The RSV renders, there He veiled His power. Both strength and majesty are combined in the Hebrew word rendered power. The Shekinah light in the Most Holy constituted the hiding place of the divine glory. It veiled Yahweh's majesty and glory, the full manifestation of which would be too much for flesh to gaze upon. Yahweh clothes Himself with light as with a garment, and the splendor of His presence is such that the eye of man cannot behold it. Even the manifestation of that glory in the angels was said to cause the Roman soldiers to shake and become as dead men. The angel told Moses, "Thou cannot see my face, for there is no man that can see me and live." Thus the full shining forth of the divine glory, even in a created, glorified being, is beyond what mortal man can look upon. In the early stages of the conquest of the nations by Christ and the saints, the divine glory will be restrained and they will appear as mortal men. From the illustration of the transfiguration, the personal appearance of the saints will be splendid with brightness. But there is reason to believe that they will not be distinguishable from ordinary men in appearance until the labors are accomplished. When the angels visited Sodom, the citizens did not discern any difference between them and Lot. And so it will be with the saints who arise to execute judgment upon the judgment written upon the great city, which is spiritually called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. The nature of their work requires that they should have the aspect common to humanity, which is not at all incompatible with the symbolical glory of their body corporate. If they flashed light from their persons, as the sun shoots forth his rays, their enemies would be so panic-stricken that they would not stand and fight, by which their punishment would be greatly impeded. The resurrected saints will therefore appear upon the theater of war as Adam and Jesus when they first emerged from the earth. Jesus was mistaken for the gardener. Note with Jesus, there was a typical interval of 40 days before he was received up into glory. You know, there's more, you know, when the ark was carried through the wilderness, the Shekinah glory of the ark was covered by the veil. You know, the glory was not in manifest and openly. It was, I think that's another, you know, another symbol that we can see, another type that kind of foreshadows this period. The Shekinah glory was concealed. Let's look at Zechariah 14, verse 6. Now I'm going to read You follow along, and I'm going to read Brother Thomas's translation of this from in Eureka. He has in Eureka, and it's quite different. And we've already looked at this passage once this morning, or real close. We've been in this 14th chapter, but Brother Thomas is talking about the hiding of the power. And he says, "Now, according to this arrangement, Zechariah testifies, saying that when the Mount of Olives shall be rent asunder by an earthquake, Yahweh, my Elohim, shall come in, all the saints with thee. And it shall be in that day there shall be no brightness. The splendid ones shall draw in. And it shall be one day that shall be known to Yahweh, not day nor night, and it shall be at the time of evening, and there shall be brightness. And Yahweh shall be king, be for king over all the earth, and that day there shall be one Yahweh, and his name one." So this word is translated in our Bibles. It says in verse 6, "And it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall be not clear nor dark." So this word dark has the meaning to draw in. So that's where Brother Thomas translates this: "The splendid ones shall draw in, or their glory shall be concealed," in other words. Now, we're going to close up. There's a quote. We barely got the rainbowed angel started from Sinai. His work continues 40 years and goes throughout the whole earth. And then the influence of his work lasts 1,000 years. So we didn't really even scratch the surface any. But it's so exciting. And I think I'd be remiss if I didn't encourage all of you, if you hadn't already, I know many of you already have, read Phanerosis, and read these expositions for yourself and study them for yourself, because it's hard to convey and say excitement. You've got to build it in your own self. But this is referring to Habakkuk's prayer in Psalm in chapter 3. The musical form of this prayer psalm has led some to believe that Habakkuk was a Levite attached to the temple. That may well be so. The apocalypse of glory revealed in this chapter taught the prophet and teaches us that the best way to solve problems such as he experienced is to fix our vision upon the joy set before us and so anticipate the coming of the Mighty One from Teman and the glory then to be revealed. The prophet saw it as the shining forth of the sun from the heavens. He saw the world trembling before the divine wrath to be revealed through that Mighty One. He saw the inevitability of the fury of the divine judgment that is yet to be seen in the world. He saw more. He saw that these experiences are necessary to the revelation of full glory in the age to come. And this is the mercy involved in this work. The only way to save the world is to destroy the evil, and that wonderful work of the Mighty One will do. And that, the wonderful work of the Mighty One will do. Finally, glory to God in the highest. On earth, peace and goodwill toward men will prevail. Let us profit from the problems of the moment by setting our spiritual vision upon that future. Then we, like the prophet, will be able to proclaim, "Though yet I will rejoice in Yahweh, I will joy in the God of my salvation." Thank you.